Okay, I'm Jessica Young. I'm one of the breast surgeons here. I've been here for about 3 years. Just a little about me. I went to medical school in Philadelphia, did my training in Pittsburgh in general surgery, and I did my fellowship here at Roswell, actually, and then stayed on as faculty. So if any of you are interested in medical school, I would first tell you not to do it. But if you still persevere past that, I'm happy to answer any questions for you. Being a doctor is awesome. It's just a very long process, and it involves a ton more paperwork than you might think, especially for someone who's a surgeon. I do an awful lot of paperwork. Okay, but my focus is breast cancer only. Breast cancer treatment is really not just one modality anymore. It's really what we call a multidisciplinary approach. So we're going to talk about a lot of different things today. There's a lot of material, I think like 80-something slides, so I apologize if I go fast, but I do want to be able to answer any questions you have. You can interrupt me in the middle if you want, or we can talk about it at the end, okay? Okay, so breast disease 101. I'm not sure what you know or don't know, so if you feel like this is way too elementary and you already heard it all, like just, I don't know, wave your arms and I'll go faster. But what we're going to talk about today are really the basics of breast cancer treatment. So history and physical, what the screening guidelines are, what risk factors might be, what we do for people who are at higher risk, what you do with a mass, what if it turns out to be a cancer, how we treat that, and then there are some special situations that we face a lot in surgery that we might want to look at. So, okay. I think I skipped one. Nope. Okay. So the incidence of breast cancer, this is the most common kind of cancer for females in the world. However, it is the second most common kind of cancer death. Does anyone know the first common kind of, what's the first?
Lung.
It's always lung, okay? So prostate is the number one cancer for males, breast is the number one cancer for females. Lung, however, is the number one killer by cancer for both. Okay, so 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in North America, although that number is kind of general because it does change just a little bit by race. There have been huge significant advances in breast cancer treatment and in the ability to screen for the disease. So thankfully, I work in a relatively happy cancer in that most patients come to me with a treatable, curable form, okay? So let's start off with the history and physical. Some things that you want when someone comes in to see you. So you want to know what brings them in. Did they feel something? Was there something seen on their mammogram? Why is it that you're seeing them for this breast issue? Beyond that, you want to know, have they had any screening before? Is this their very first mammogram or whatever they had done? Have they had any history of abnormal imaging before? Have they had any biopsies before, issues? Then, of course, family history, very important, especially in breast. You want to know about breast cancer. You also want to know about ovarian cancer as well as other cancers, but breast and ovarian are probably the top two that you want to know about. We do ask when they started having their periods, if they're postmenopausal and all that, because it figures into their own personal history. If they've received any other cancer treatments, specifically radiation treatments, okay? But other cancer treatments, have you had chemotherapy before? And then, of course, you always want to ask things in the review system. So how long have you felt this for? But even more generally than that, when we talk about cancer, have you had any unintentional weight loss? That's a very funny thing to ask a female because body image being what it is, most females are trying to lose weight all the time. But if they weren't really trying and they suddenly lost 10 pounds in the last couple months, that's weird. That's not easy to do, right? I'm here to tell you it's not easy to lose 10 pounds no matter how hard you try. So if there's a female that comes to you and says, man, you know, I've been losing weight a little more than I feel like I should or whatever, that's a little bit of a questionable thing, right? Do they have any new pains in their muscles or bones? Do they have unexplained fatigue? Are there any new symptoms that they haven't had that have come up within the past 6 months or so, let's say, okay? Okay, physical exam. So we generally start with physical exam with the lymph nodes just because that's sort of the area that's easiest when they're sitting up. So just to give you an idea, we're really looking at the cervical, the supraclavicular, infraclavicular, and axillary bases. Axillary is obviously the most common area for them to go to, but you want to feel all along those areas as well. If you feel something in the neck, actually, that's pretty bad. That's probably not breast cancer, or if it is, it means it's very advanced breast cancer. But you may feel lymph nodes or fullness above the clavicle or underneath the clavicle, and then underneath the arms. These pictures are just illustrating a little bit about how to do under the arms. The point of an underarm exam is that the pectoralis muscle is right here. Sorry, I point to myself a lot. So the pectoralis muscle is right here. You want it to be relaxed when you're examining someone, which is always weird when you go into a stranger's room, you have cold hands, and you start feeling under their arms. It's a very weird thing. They get very tense. So you kind of want to hold their arm or just have them take pressure off their arm so that you can kind of feel under that area to see if they have any abnormally large nodes or not. Of course, you always want to do both sides, even if there's something suspicious only on one side, because you want to compare, right? Maybe this person has large nodes on both sides, which might be cancer, or might be lymphoma, or might be completely normal, or, you know. Sometimes you feel something on this side, and you're like, well, I'm not sure if that's normal or not, and you feel on the other side, it's probably normal, okay? Just their anatomy. In terms of the breast exam, you want to examine them both upright and when they're laying down, okay? So when they're upright, we often have our patients lift their arms up and everything. So even without touching them, you may notice some contour changes, okay? They might have flattening or dimpling or something that you might not notice if their arms are just down because suddenly they have tension in a different way. Then in terms of doing the actual breast exam itself, whichever method you should pick, just be consistent about it, okay? So don't, you know, go vertically suddenly and then change over to a spiral or something like that. Pick one way, do it all the way around, and see what you feel. A lot of women are going to feel very dense, especially when they're young, because that's just the way that it is. It does take a lot of practice to do breast exams before you feel things. Sometimes things are super, super obvious and right there, so you want to note all of that there. That's squeezing of the nipple to try to get out discharge. I generally actually don't really do that unless patients are complaining of that, because discharge is actually a fairly normal thing. And also, it's kind of painful to do that to a woman. But if you're worried about it, they can also do it to themselves. So what are you looking for on your exam? Size and symmetry are important. However, most women do not have symmetrical breasts. One is usually larger than the other, and that's a normal thing. It doesn't mean anything bad or good, okay? Sometimes it's a little bit asymmetrical, sometimes it's very asymmetrical. So you want to notice if there's any flattening or dimpling of the breast area. You want to notice if there's any erythema, edematous changes, or what we call peau d'orange changes. Peau d'orange changes, this is a very typical word that we use in medical school, basically skin of an orange, right? So if your skin is so swollen in the breast, it causes a little dimpling from where where the skin, it like puffs out, and you can see the little dimpling of the skin. Nipples, you want to note if they're retracted or inverted, if there's any ulcerations. Having an inverted nipple, again, is not necessarily a bad thing, but you always want to ask, is this a new inversion? Is this a new retraction? Because that might indicate to you that there's something underneath pulling it backwards. If you feel a mass or a nodule, you want to know where it is, about what size you think it is, if it's mobile or not, or if it's fixed to your chest wall, if it's tender. In general, for breasts, we tend to refer to masses by location like a clock face, okay? So if I'm facing the patient here, it's my clock. So if there's a mass over here, this is maybe 1 or 2 o'clock. That's what I kind of say in my note. It's 2 o'clock, about 2 or 3 centimeters from the nipple. I felt a 2-centimeter mass that was fixed to the chest wall. That's an easily reproducible exam that the next person reading this can also see and say the same thing. This is the whole point, is that you want anyone else to be able to look at your note and say, oh, I know where that is, okay? In the axilla, you want to note if you feel any nodes, if the nodes, you know, you can feel a node on people who, especially people who are real skinny, you can feel lymph nodes, so that doesn't necessarily mean anything bad, but you want to note if you feel any, if you feel them on both sides, if they have any infections or like odd pigmentations of their breast. Nipple discharge, if you notice it, again, you want to know what color it came out, consistency, so it can be watery, creamy, it can be brown, green, clear, white, yellow, if it came out of one duct, multiple ducts, if it came out of both breasts. So these are all things that you want to describe in your physical exam. Okay, so just some pictures of abnormal findings. Some of these are my patients, some of them are not. So really this one is at the top here is just a little bit of a, it's actually more of a cleaved nipple or just slightly inverted, okay, as compared to, say, the one on that side there. This one, obviously, something really nasty is going on, and I'll tell you that people present like this all the time. The power of denial is extremely strong, okay? They also present like that. That is not normal asymmetry, okay? When I'm saying that people are asymmetrical and that it can be normal, that's not what I'm talking about. She obviously has an advanced cancer. Up there, I don't know if you can notice in the corner, there are two kinds of discharge actually coming from this woman's nipple. One is dark and bloody, and one is not, and that is possible to have two different kinds. And then up at the top, that's an example of an orange beside someone who has orange peel-like skin. Okay? Okay, so let's talk about screening guidelines, because this is sort of the basics. When should an average risk woman start screening? Anyone know the age? 40. Okay. The answer is a little, 40 is the answer that I would put on a test if I had to ask you a question. So these are the ACS guidelines as of 2010. However, they were recently updated. So what this is really saying is that breast self-exam is probably the most important for an average risk woman from about the age of 20 to about the age of 40. They're actually emphasizing more and more that clinical self-breast exams are not that important. What that really means is that women don't do self-breast exams anyways, very rarely, okay? But if they do them, that it's not really helping us to pick up early cancers, okay? So the most important thing that you can do across the board is to get screening, like for anything, really. But for breast cancer screening, we know that that really works. But in their 20s and 30s, they should start getting clinical breast exams, meaning a breast exam by a physician, so usually their gynecologist or their primary care physician, and then begin annual mammography at age 40. Okay. However, just this past year in October 2015, the American Cancer Society changed their recommendations and really said that they recommended fewer mammograms. Okay. So screen later, screen less often. What they really said was not to start screening until the age of 45 and to maybe consider doing it every other year instead of every year. There was a huge amount of controversy and a lot of people really freaking out over these new guidelines. And I will say this, the American Cancer Society is not the only one who puts out screening recommendations. So the other groups that also put out national guideline recommendations have not changed what they feel. But we're not saying that this is necessarily wrong. I just want to go over this and explain sort of what they meant by it, and then we'll move on from there. So they really say that you can consider not starting till you're 45. Okay, and this isn't an average risk woman again, so people who don't really have family history, don't have other risk factors. And then at age 55, they can start going to every other year. And then when to stop is always a great question, but generally practitioners recommend that you continue getting screening exams of any kind as long as you think you have a 5 to 10 year lifespan. Who can really predict that? But it's really whether you're able or willing to take treatments for what you're doing. So don't look for a problem if you're not planning to fix the problem in the end, right? So if you can't have surgery because your heart is terrible and the second we give you a little propofol, you're gonna have a huge massive heart attack, don't look for a breast mass. Let's just not even look at it because there's no way to solve that or fix it, okay? What these guidelines we're sort of aiming towards is that we do have a lot of problems with what we consider over-treatment or over-diagnosis of a lot of things that are either cancer very, very early that we don't know about, DCIS, we'll talk about that another time, it's very controversial, or even just a lot of what we call false positives. So women are often brought in for a biopsy of some sort that turns out to be nothing, which causes a lot of anxiety, it's very expensive to society, et cetera, et cetera. And so these guidelines were sort of meant to alleviate this on a breast community level, okay? But in general, per person, we still really feel that everyone should be screened at 40. That sounds like a very confusing thing, but they're really looking at it from like, not an institutional, but like on a national overall review, what's best for healthcare. They're not looking at the individuals here, okay? Okay. Getting past that, screening works, okay? Breast cancer screening is one of those big, wins for the healthcare community. So for every 1,000 women who have a screening mammogram, though, you have to understand that 100 are called to have some other sort of imaging, okay? Another mammogram or an ultrasound or whatever. 20 are then recommended to have some sort of biopsy, and only 5 of those 20 actually have cancer. So you can see how much distress this is causing. So 900 women are fine, that's great. But another, 95 rather, are going through needless anxiety and worry about that. But the thing is that we know that screening with mammograms does work. It's really reduced the breast cancer mortality rate in the US by nearly a third since 1990 when they started having regular screening recommendations, and that's huge, okay? if you think about 1 in 8 women in the United States needing that, that is, there's like 400 million people, so that's 50 million people a year who, you know, so there's a lot going on there. Okay, screening mammogram. This clearly is a breast, so density shows up as dark, so that's what that density is. That little triangle is means that they had a palpable mass, so they put a marker over it that you can see. This breast is fairly fatty replaced, is what we call it, meaning that it's mostly dark and should be easy to see masses that are there. We have what's called a BI-RADS scoring system. This is for radiologists that sort of say how suspicious is what they're seeing. So most people are either level 1 or level 2, meaning they have a completely normal mammogram or they have just benign findings that no one's really worried about. Level 3 means they sort of see something, but it's probably not that suspicious. We're not even worried about biopsying it, but let's look at it again in 6 months. Level 4 is when it's highly suspicious, they should definitely have a biopsy. 5 is the same thing, and then 6 is this is a cancer. We biopsied and we know that it's cancer. 0 means we need more information. It doesn't necessarily mean anything bad. It just means we need more information, old images or whatever. This is the national system. And okay, the other thing I want to mention with just about screening, in January of 2013, New York State passed a law saying that every mammogram report given to a patient who has dense breasts now has to state that the patient has dense breasts. This caused a lot of issues for me personally. It's all about me, right? When the patients came in and they started freaking out saying, why do I have dense breasts? Why do I get this report? What can I do about it? So on and so forth. It's not that their density became suddenly real. It's that they were never informed about their density before, and now we are. So now there's a lot of other things that we may use for screening as well, like ultrasound, MRI, or even tomosynthesis, or what's called 3D mammograms, to help with density. I won't really go into that any further, but that is like fairly big legislation, and it's actually not just in New York State. It's passed now in, I'm not even sure, but probably over half the states now have to say that as well, and there's a lot of legislation in the rest of them. Okay, before we get into breast cancer, though, let's talk about what puts you at risk for breast cancer. So most people think that it's just your family history that puts you at risk for breast cancer, okay? But actually, it's two separate areas. Family history certainly puts you at risk, but there's your own personal risk factors as well. So if you had your period very early, if you had menopause late, if you had, you know, a lot of kids versus no kids, or when you had them, if you've received radiation to your chest, if you've had previous biopsies, these all contribute to your risk factors for breast cancer, okay? So here are risk factors that cannot be changed. You can't really change being a girl, and clearly women are more at risk than men. You can't really change that we age, okay? That's the number two risk factor is age. You can't change whether your parents had it, you know, on either side, unfortunately. You can't pick your race. You can't pick whether, so there was some treatment with DES. So DES is diethyl something. It's what they used to give women who are pregnant way before. They don't give it anymore because it's obviously teratogenic, but it puts women, babies who are born at risk. That's not really a huge one anymore. If you've needed radiation for something, you can't really change that. If you have some sort of mutation, can't really change that. I wish we could figure out when we started or stopped our periods. Clearly we can't change that. And how many kids you have, I suppose you can change that, but most people don't base their risk level and say, well, let me have kids now just to avoid that. Okay, breast cancer risk factors that can be controlled, obesity, how much you exercise, whether you breastfeed or not, how much alcohol you drink, if you've taken hormone replacement therapy, birth control pills, and not having children. So these are all things that you can sort of control to help your risk level. All of these different risk factors have like a different amount that it weighs into it, okay? So age over 65, the relative risk is 5.8. That's really high. So as we age, your risk of breast cancer gets higher, okay? Having your period a little bit earlier, really not that significant. So anything off of 1 is a little bit higher, other thing not. Okay, gene mutations, huge, right? If you have a gene mutation, that really highly predicts whether you're going to have breast cancer or not. Breast density is at a level 4. It's not, there's a lot of controversy about that, but we do think sometimes that breast density does increase your risk for breast cancer. Some people don't believe that. They think it's just harder to see. It's a little hard to figure that out. Hormone replacement therapy, you can see there, 2.7 with estrogen and progesterone, or 1.96 with estrogen. So we encourage women, if they don't need to take hormone replacement therapy, not to take it. Okay. Okay. So how do we assess them, though? What if they have multiple factors or whatever? So there's a lot of risk assessment models that we use in our clinic every day to help figure out whether someone's at higher risk or not. So the most popular model is probably called the GAIL model. It's also called the National Cancer Institute Risk Assessment Model. So if you look that up, it's free, available online, very easy to use. It looks at a number of different factors, but this is mostly factors related to personal risk, okay? So how old are you? When did you have your period? How old were you when you gave birth to your first child? How many first degree relatives do you have who have had breast cancer? Have you had any breast biopsies in the past? Have they been atypical? And then what race are you? So you kind of put in all these different numbers and you can come out with a risk level as compared to the general population. This is the most popular model, so that's why I'm giving you more detail about it. It's not to be used in women who are under the age of 35. It's not validated for that. Or if they have DCIS or LCIS. So DCIS is considered a form of cancer. LCIS is considered a large risk marker. You can't use either of those. Or a BRCA mutation obviously completely throws us off. This is for someone who's average risk, okay? It doesn't, though, include much about your second-degree family history. It clearly doesn't include your male history because first degree really is only your mother. So if you have a brother or a father who had breast cancer, it's not going to take that into account. And then, you know, there are other models that are available that emphasize family history or put together this a little bit more. But this is our most well-validated model. It came out of something called the Women's Health Study, which is a very, very large study from which a lot of different things came out. But that's why it's very well-validated. Okay, this is just an example of what it looks like. If you go to the website, drop-down menu, very easy to use. So it gives you a 5-year risk of breast cancer, and it gives you an approximate lifetime risk of breast cancer up to the age of about 90, okay? So 1 in 8 is about 13%. So if you're average risk, your risk for breast cancer just from sporadic reasons is about 13%. And then generally your 5-year risk does change as you go up over time, but less than 1.5 is pretty average. It's not anything to really worry about. So it gives you a number higher or even lower than the general population to give you an idea of what your personal risk level is. Okay, so what can we do for those people who are at high risk for breast cancer then? Okay, there are some things that we can do. They can have genetics counseling and testing if they qualify for it. They can have more surveillance, so not just mammograms at 40, maybe they need mammograms at 30. Maybe they need mammograms and MRIs. There are some different lifestyle things. There are drugs we can give, and always we ask about prophylactic surgery because since Angelina Jolie, that's been a very popular thing to do. Okay, so let's talk about the risk of breast cancer. In the general population, the general population without any risk factors. This is sort of a confusing slide. Okay, let's pull this back a little bit. Most breast cancers are what we call sporadic, okay? So about 70 to 75% of breast cancers have no real known risk factors. Most women who get breast cancer are in this category, okay? Then there are about BRCA mutations, which they're not the only mutations out there now, but mutations probably account for anywhere between 5 to 10% of breast cancer cases. So we talk about BRCA all the time, you hear about celebrities who have BRCA all the time, but in actuality, BRCA is not most people who get breast cancer. And then there are people who have breast cancer who have a pretty strong family history, but for whatever reason don't have a known mutation yet. That's like 15 to 20% of people, okay? So you can see that their average risk of breast cancer to age 70 varies really wildly, okay? And it goes up. So if you have a strong family history, it's higher. If you have a BRCA mutation, it's really, really high. If you're average risk, it's really not as high. So again, this is just another way. So most people are sporadic. So people sort of think it's, you know, for a lot of different reasons, but they don't have strong risk factors for it. Okay. So most women, again, are not at high risk of breast cancer. However, and having just one relative who had breast cancer at a postmenopausal age, that's really common, okay? So one relative really doesn't cut it, even if it's like your mom or your sister or something. And most women who think they're at high risk do not really benefit from testing, okay? Testing is widely available now, but most people are going to turn out to be negative, so we really want to be careful about who we're screening because it's pretty expensive. you should always have counseling before you have testing. That's just an important point for that. Okay, genetics testing, again, we talked about it, account for less than 10% of breast cancers, count for less than 15% of ovarian cancers. So BRCA mutations not only predispose you towards breast cancer risk, but it predisposes you towards ovarian and other cancers as well. The BRCA gene, or what it is that it encodes for a protein that fights cancer, okay? So if there's a mutation in the DNA that gives you funky protein, the funky protein is not going to fight cancer as well, thereby allowing you to develop breast, ovarian, and other kinds of cancer. Does that make sense? So a BRCA, it gets a bad rap because you always see BRCA, BRCA. BRCA is a good thing. It's when you have a mutation of it that it's a bad thing. So it does put you at susceptibility. There's two major types, one and two, but actually even within those types, there's like a million different kinds. So if I have BRCA and you have BRCA, we probably have different BRCA, okay? There's a lot of other gene mutations now as well, TP53, P10, these are all much less common. Genetic testing has exploded in the last even 5 years, and so now they're finding things that they say are mutated that we don't even know if it's going to cause a problem or not in the future. So it's, you want to be very careful about who actually gets testing because it may not help the situation. They may come back and say, well, I have this weird variant on this gene here, what does that mean? And all I can tell them is we have no idea. It's not, we don't have enough evidence to really give you a good idea of that yet, okay? Okay. So screening criteria, this is for getting genetics testing. Some of the major ones, if you have anyone in the family who's male and had breast cancer, if you have anyone in the family who has a BRCA mutation, you should yourself probably be tested. If you have anybody who has ovarian cancer in the family, or if you have ovarian cancer, you should be tested. And then it's going to be people who have, like, who are younger than normal age, so under the age of 45, under the age of 50, under the age of 50 with certain kinds of cancer, or if you have really aggressive prostate cancer. So BRCA in males can cause breast cancer, of course, but also causes a fairly aggressive kind of prostate cancer. So when you kind of see these little warning signs, these are the people who are more appropriate for testing, okay? And the Ashkenazi Jewish. They mention the Ashkenazi Jewish a lot in medical school. Anytime you see them, you can send them for testing pretty much, okay? Okay, BRCA, again, higher prevalence in the Ashkenazi Jewish, also in like the Netherlands, Sweden, Hungary, French Canada. I'm from Canada, but not the French part. These are autosomal dominant mutations, meaning that if I have the mutation, I give every child I have a 50% chance of getting that mutation. It is not a sex-linked mutation, okay? So it does not come from mother to daughter, it goes from parent to child. That's an important point because a lot of people don't think their father's side of the family matters when that could be rampant with cancer. It can get passed down. And your males are more like silent carriers in a lot of ways because they don't manifest a cancer, but it doesn't mean they don't have the mutation. Okay? Okay. Breast cancer in BRCA1 is worse for females, anywhere between 36 to 87% for BRCA2, 45 to 84%, much higher for ovarian cancer as well. Incidentally, if you are a male, you would rather have BRCA1 than 2, but if you're a female, you'd rather have 2 than 1. If you need an easy way to remember that, although you probably don't need to remember that, females have 1 uterus and males have 2 balls. That's the way I kind of remembered it through medical school, okay? Whatever you gotta do is whatever you gotta do. Okay, so if you have BRCA, we recommend that you get yearly mammograms, but also MRIs, starting at about the age of 25 to 30, so much earlier than we would normally screen. You should probably consider prophylactic mastectomies because at some point in time, breast cancer is probably going to hit you. You don't have to, but that's something that kids strongly consider. A lot of women will be recommended to have their ovaries taken out bilaterally by the age of 35 or when they're done with childbearing. Ovarian cancer, you saw by the previous slide, is much less than breast cancer. However, ovarian cancer, even when we're looking for it, we don't find it very easily. And when it presents, it's much more late stage, and it's just unfortunately a much more lethal disease than breast cancer is, okay? So also, as a plus, when you take out your ovaries, you can probably reduce your breast cancer risk by about 50% or so. If you choose not to do that, you should get transvaginal ultrasounds and blood work every 6 months. and along with your yearly MRIs and mammograms. Okay. You can take some drugs to decrease the risk of breast cancer. This is not just for people who are BRCA, but also people who are at higher risk without having BRCA. The most common one is probably tamoxifen. This is a drug that we also use to treat breast cancer. However, we know from really extremely large studies that if you are at higher risk for breast cancer and you take tamoxifen for 5 years, it'll decrease your risk by about 50%. And it probably reduces the risk in BRCA1 and 2 carriers as well, however, probably not by 50%. But we don't have great numbers on that because it's really hard to run a trial in such a small population. In terms of chemo prevention for ovarian cancer, actually oral contraceptives are what they recommend until you're ready to take your ovaries out for there. Okay, you can read this stuff. These are the other less common but still possible genetic mutations. Again, this is what you can do for them, but you can just read that. It's pretty much the same as it is for BRCA. Lifestyle modifications. So there are some things that you can do that don't involve taking drugs or taking your breasts off that can help to decrease your risk of breast cancer. I tell all my patients about it, male or female, because they're all good health practices. It's only been found to be effective in postmenopausal females, though. It includes maintaining an ideal body weight, decreasing alcohol intake to less than one drink per day, not smoking, and then also actually just physical activity is noted to be an independent risk factor. So even if you're a bigger person, if you are more active, your risk of breast cancer will be lower. Okay? The alcohol thing is definitely by amount that you take. It's a little hard to quantify, but obviously the more you drink, the higher the risk. Most of these are probably related to how much body fat you have. In postmenopausal women, obviously the ovaries are no longer putting out estrogen. However, the adrenal glands still do, but estrogen gets stored in fat. So the more fat that you have, the more estrogen that is available in your body to uptake. Okay? Same thing for males, but we haven't run a trial on males because it's really hard to do. So we already talked about this a little bit. This is the chemo prevention, but in average risk women, they should have at least a greater than 1.67 or basically 1.7% 5-year risk. So when you put them into the model, then you pull it out. Those are the women that you offer it to if they're over the age of 35. Tamoxifen increases the rate of, it's great, it does great things for you, but it also can cause endometrial cancer, clots in your legs or lungs, or formation of cataracts. So if you have any issues with that, you don't want to recommend tamoxifen. And actually, the risk of endometrial cancer certainly freaks a lot of people out and stops them from taking it. Obviously, there are some contraindications at the bottom there. There are some other drugs that you can take. Raloxifene is very similar to tamoxifen. It doesn't work quite as well in invasive cancers, but it has still a pretty good risk reduction. And then you don't really need to know about this trial, but it is one of the trials doing it. You can also take aromatase inhibitors. Aromatase inhibitors are only for postmenopausal women. Premenopausal women can take them, but it doesn't really do anything for them. Okay. So what the aromatase inhibitors do is that your body's process of making estrogen, the last step is converted by something called aromatase. So if you inhibit the conversion of pre-estrogen essentially to the final form of estrogen, the pre-estrogen is not really recognized by cancer cells. And so that's what we think really decreases the risk of breast cancer there. Aromatase inhibitors don't have the risk of clots or endometrial cancer and stuff, but it does decrease your bone density. So you have to watch for that, but that's about one of its only major side effects. They're not technically FDA approved for chemo prevention, even though exemestane has been proven in large trials, but we use exemestane very regularly for it. That's one of the aromatase inhibitors. We do a lot of things that are not FDA approved in medicine. So, okay, prophylactic surgery. So these are recommended only for women who are at the highest risk, essentially mutation carriers. And you can have a mastectomy, meaning removal of the breast and the nipple. You can have skin-sparing mastectomies, meaning you have some sort of reconstruction, so you're saving a lot of skin. You can have nipple-sparing mastectomies, so you save the nipple. Although it doesn't have sensation or function, it still looks nice and is there. You can have reconstruction or not. And then again, taking out your ovaries will help decrease the risk of breast cancer as well as decrease your risk of ovarian cancer. Okay, we have a program at Roswell. Specifically for women who don't have cancer but strong family histories or whatever to get in to talk about these different options. Okay, let's move on to breast cancer then. How does breast cancer usually present? It's usually asymptomatic, okay? It's now thankfully found by abnormal imaging. You can see a mass, calcification, some sort of asymmetry or density. It can present as a palpable mass, especially in younger women who are not regularly undergoing screening. They can have breast pain, although I will say breast pain is not usually indicative of breast cancer. You can have nipple discharge, redness of the breast, changes to the nipple. You can just have something presenting under your arm with no breast mass at all, or any sort of alterations to the skin. So a lot of different ways. After your history and physical, you want to get some imaging, right? You want to know what's going on. If they haven't had any already, they probably want a mammogram. If they have a mass there, they usually look at it with an ultrasound. You may opt to have an MRI or not. It sort of depends. And then the rest of these, you can have a 3D mammogram if your breasts are sort of dense. You will need some sort of biopsy, so tissue diagnosis of the lesion. That's what a punch or core biopsy will do. And then the CTs, PET scans, and bone scans, that just depends on how far advanced you think the cancer is. So mammography is our baseline thing that we do. It's cheap, it's relatively small amounts of radiation, and it's a very good test. So it has a good sensitivity and specificity, almost about 90%, and it's inexpensive. That's why we use it for screening. Ultrasound, some women do get ultrasound for screening, but it's just not that great for it. If you can feel a palpable mass, if I could say, here it is, I feel something right here, ultrasound is fantastic, because you can put it right down there and look at it. But an ultrasound is very user dependent. If you've ever seen an ultrasound for a pregnant woman, you know, if you turn your hand a little this way, it doesn't look like a baby anymore. If you turn it this way, you know, it looks completely different. So it's very dependent on the person who's doing the actual ultrasound. So it's better for things that you really know are there. MRI is great for dense breasts. It can also evaluate other abnormalities that you might not see on mammogram. We use it for high-risk screening. However, it's an expensive test. It requires you to have an IV and can cause kidney issues. But it does not give you any radiation, okay? MRI stands for magnetic resonance imaging. You can do it on pregnant people. There's no issues with that. Okay, so here are just some examples of imaging. This is a mammogram. Again, the white is very dense. You can see the white. If there's a mass in there, it can hide actually fairly easily in that white. Okay, that's why dense breasts are very difficult to image. An example of an ultrasound there up top with a mass with a little X on it, and then the MRI below. That's one image of an MRI. An MRI has about 3,000 images. Okay, so a biopsy, you can do an FNA, you can do a core biopsy. An FNA is a real tiny needle that kind of just pulls out a few cells. It's not really getting an actual piece of tissue. We prefer not to do that unless there's an issue. We prefer a core biopsy almost all the time. It's a larger gauge needle, so bigger needle, takes more tissue, and they take multiple pieces of tissue so we can get a better diagnosis. And usually the imagers, the radiologists, are the ones who do the biopsies. If they really can't get it, we do a surgical biopsy. So yesterday I did surgery on a woman where she didn't get a biopsy beforehand because they had too much difficulty trying to get it, so we took her to the operating room just to take it out. But we try not to take people to the operating room who don't need it. Okay, this is what we call a stereotactic biopsy. Doesn't it look like fun? It's really awesome to be a woman, let me tell you. Okay, so they numb you up. You're like, you know, your breast is clamped into this thing, and then they use a mammogram to kind of direct yourself towards whatever the abnormality is. This is basically more of an ultrasound-guided biopsy. A little more comfortable, not that much more comfortable. Okay. The breast ductal and lobular system, so the ducts and the lobules are the main areas where cancer comes from, okay? The lobules are where we make breast milk. That's what the point of the lobules are, so they're kind of out towards the periphery, but you have probably about 15 to 20 duct lobule systems in your system, and then the ducts are the cells leading out towards the nipple, so they line the tunnels where the breast milk goes through. So you can have a normal duct, you can have hyperplasia, meaning buildup of normal cells, you could have atypical kind of cells that are built up but not cancerous, you can have ductal carcinoma in situ, which is considered a kind of cancer, but that's DCIS, so you can see the abnormal cells have not left the area, or you can have invasive cancer where they've already penetrated and gone outside that area, and that's the most common kind of breast cancer. So just another schematic for that. This is the lobule and the ducts leading out that way. Okay, ductal carcinoma in situ, I won't spend a huge amount of time on it, but this is a non-invasive form of carcinoma, okay? So again, the cells of the cancer have not left the duct yet, and therefore it has not had the potential to go anywhere else. Whereas invasive cancer, it's already left the local area, it has the potential to have gone somewhere else. So we're finding it more and more. It actually accounts for about 25% of breast cancer. Especially we're finding it by screening mammogram. There's a lot of controversy about whether it's cancer or not, but the answer right now is that it is cancer. In 10 years at this lecture, the answer may be that not all forms are cancer. We don't know, okay? We're really bad at figuring that out. Infiltrating ductal carcinoma, same thing. Invasive infiltrating is the most common kind of breast cancer. Lobular cancers account for probably about 10% of breast cancers, not as common, but not uncommon. And then there's a bunch of other kinds that you can also get. Staging, this is what we do in order to tell someone how far we think the cancer has spread. It's done by what we call the TMN staging, it's metastases, it should be TNM, sorry. So tumor, first we're describing how big we think this area is. Nodes, whether we feel them or not. And then metastases, if we image them, we know that there's disease elsewhere. That gives us an idea. Traditionally, prognostic factors for how bad your cancer are includes the number of positive lymph nodes you have. That's probably the number one most powerful tool we have to figure out if you have disease elsewhere or anything else, is how many nodes positive you have. The size of your cancer is also important. And then the grade is also important. You want to be a lower grade if you can. There's only 3 grades, 1, 2, and 3. So you want to be 1 rather than 3. You can see here by stage what their survivals are. So stage 0 is DCIS. So if it's non-invasive, no matter how much you have, that's stage 0. So those people do very well. Stage 1 is also still very well. Even stage 2 and stage 3, very, very well going on out. Actually, I would argue the numbers are probably a little bit bold. So probably even up to stage 3, we're talking about, certainly at 5 years, we're talking about 80 to 90% survival. And of course it goes down a little bit as you go out, but it's not that bad. Stage 4, disease known elsewhere, people can still actually live for a fairly long amount of time with this, with modern day treatments. Another factor that we look at on cancers itself, there are 3 biomarkers that we specifically look at now. There's a bunch more that people are always testing to see if they're significant or not. But the 3 that we always check are the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and the human epidermal growth factor, or HER2 for short. Okay, so these are tested on all breast cancers, and they give us an idea not only about how the cancer is going to behave, but it also gives us an idea about what they're going to respond to. Okay? So estrogen and progesterone being positive is better. These are slower growing, less aggressive cancers overall. Having the HER2 is a worse marker, so it tends to be a more aggressive kind. You don't want to have that. But there are specific targeted treatments for both of those, the estrogen, progesterone, and the HER2. So if you have it, you're going to get a specific treatment for it, and we'll talk about that. Where does breast cancer go to? I mean, it can go anywhere, but the most common places for it to go to are going to be lung, liver, brain, and bones. Okay? So if you are worried about disease being elsewhere, these are the common areas that you want to scan to check. We really don't scan every person who has invasive cancer, even though it's possible that it's there. But because it's really, until you hit about stage 3, you're not going to see things on scans. It doesn't mean that you don't have any disease anywhere else just because it doesn't show up on a scan. Scans are not that good. They're not that sensitive, okay? But if it doesn't show up on a scan, but you're stage 1 or stage 2 and you still have invasive cancer, we still assume you have microscopic disease elsewhere that we have to treat so that it doesn't grow to become a metastatic disease. Okay, but if you can see it on a scan, that's considered metastatic disease at stage 4. Okay, so breast cancer, I told you, we treat it with different modalities now. There are 4 major ways we treat breast cancer. 2 of them treat the breast cancer that we know about in the breast, that's surgery and radiation. So I'm a surgeon. I know that if I take the breast cancer out of this breast, it's not going to affect the few microscopic cells of breast cancer that might be sitting in my liver or my lungs or wherever. Okay, same thing with radiation. You're only getting radiation to one part of the body. It's only affecting that part. Chemotherapy and endocrine therapy, though, these affect cells anywhere in the body. It doesn't have to be just in the area where we know you have breast cancer. So those are systemic therapies. So surgery, generally speaking, you can think about surgery for the breast in 2 different ways. The lymph nodes are a separate issue from the breast. So the breast, you can either have a lumpectomy or you can have a mastectomy. There's no given size at which you say, oh, there's no way I can do a mastectomy. Breasts come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So if someone has a smaller breast and they already have a 2 or 3 centimeter cancer, then they might need to have a mastectomy. There's just no way. You can have someone who has a triple F breast or whatever, and if they have a 5 centimeter cancer, they might not even notice when you take it out, okay? So that's all variable. A lumpectomy, though, so when you're just removing the area of cancer with a rim of normal tissue around it, that's going to give you a higher chance of the breast cancer coming back in that breast, right? It makes sense. You're leaving breast tissue behind. That's where it can develop. If you remove the entire breast, you're really reducing the chance it'll ever come back, but that's obviously a bigger surgery. So with a lumpectomy, we usually say that you have to have radiation with it. With a mastectomy, you usually don't. We also have to check your lymph nodes if you have an invasive cancer. So if you don't have invasive cancer, if you have that DCIS or non-invasive cancer, I won't look at your lymph nodes when we're doing your lumpectomy, okay? But even if we don't think your lymph nodes are positive because the exam doesn't show it or MRI doesn't show it, we still have to check it because we know that we're wrong about 5% of the time, and that will change the different treatments that you get later on down the road. We put a little bit of blue dye and a radioactive isotope into your breast to identify those nodes, and we take them out. If you are positive, with the central lymph nodes, we sometimes have to take out all of the lymph nodes, and that's called an axillary dissection. You don't need to know much about that except that either of these procedures can cause you to have arm swelling called lymphedema, and it's going to be higher with something with taking all the nodes out than with just a few of the nodes, and we try to avoid that. If you have the whole breast removed, you can have reconstruction. That could be an implant-based reconstruction. It could be tissue from some other part of your body that's called autologous reconstruction, so you can take it from your belly, from your lat muscle, from your butt, wherever it happens to be. Sometimes they can reconstruct a breast from that. So if you're doing, just to give you an idea, when you're doing breast conservation therapy, relatively speaking, if I tell a woman they can have a lumpectomy or breast conservation therapy, it means that I think their breast is going to look relatively normal when I take out this little area. Okay. If I feel that I can't do that, or if they just opt for it, then you can also remove the entire breast, which is tissue as marked out by those, by the diagrams. Okay, there are some times when I cannot offer a woman a lumpectomy. It has to be a mastectomy. Okay, it can be for an extensive amount of non-invasive cancer. So even though you think to yourself non-invasive cancer stage 0, which is great, and it is, sometimes you can have 20 centimeters of non-invasive cancer, and then you have to take all of that out, and that means a mastectomy. So that's a little bit of a weird thing to realize, but you have to get all of the non-invasive cancer out, but it hasn't had the potential to spread anywhere yet, which is good. If you have cancer in 2 different parts of your breast, you're going to need to have a mastectomy. So if you have one over here and one up here, I can't do a lumpectomy here and a lumpectomy here. You have to take the whole breast out because we don't know if there are cancer cells in the middle. If you have a large tumor compared to the size of the breast, obviously you need to have a mastectomy. If you can't receive radiation for some reason, so if you have a lumpectomy, we almost always say that you have to have radiation to help decrease the chance that it'll come back. But some people can't have radiation. Maybe they've had radiation before. Maybe they can't drive there every day. Radiation is a daily treatment. So some people who live in like Springville, New York, I'm making that up. I have patients from everywhere. Sometimes they have to drive like an hour to get to a radiation place, and they don't want to do that. So you don't want to recommend a lumpectomy. They have to have a mastectomy. If you're pregnant, you can't receive radiation, so you have to choose a mastectomy. Or if you have, there are some tissue diseases that also are not good with radiation. Or it may just be that the patient prefers that. They would rather decrease their chance of having any cancer come back as much as is possible, and they choose a mastectomy. However, choosing a lumpectomy with radiation versus choosing a mastectomy does not change a patient's survival, okay? So there are always 2 things that we look at when we talk about big trials and whether it's worthwhile or not. One is, what is their overall survival? And one is, what is their disease-free survival, okay? Or what is their chance of it basically coming back? So with a lumpectomy and radiation, your chance of recurrence is going to be higher, but as long as you're treated for it, you have the same survival as someone who had it come back even with a mastectomy. So we feel it's perfectly safe to offer both, even though one has a higher chance of it coming back than the other. Okay, this is just to give you an idea of what it looks like for surgery. That's kind of what it looks like when it comes out. I wish cancer looked more exciting. People are like, oh, what did it look like? Could you tell if you got it all? You really can't. It's just a big blob of breast tissue. And then, relatively speaking, you know, hopefully their scars aren't really there, but, you know, a lumpectomy, the aim is not to really see that anymore. With a mastectomy, you're removing that area plus or minus some of the lymph nodes. That's surgery when you're doing the skin flaps, taking it down. So you want, you're not wanting to leave any breast tissue really at all as you go down along the skin. You're basically skinning the breast is basically what you're doing to try to get it out. And then if they have no reconstruction, it really should be just a straight line going all the way across. If they have reconstruction, it can look a little different. This is what a mastectomy looks like when it comes out. So if you don't remove a lot of skin, so this person got reconstruction, then it's just a tiny amount around the nipple. But you could see basically the skin was removed from the breast and then it was taken out. Okay, and if you have reconstruction without nipples, if you didn't spare the nipples, that's kind of what it can look like. Okay. So the types of mastectomies, you can have skin-sparing mastectomies, you can have nipple-sparing mastectomies, so they look relatively like they have they have their nipples still at the end, and that's what it looks like if you have a nipple-sparing mastectomy. This is just how we inject the blue dye. We inject the blue dye and the radioisotope around the tumor or around your nipple, and it's supposed to go up towards those lymph nodes. The sentinel lymph nodes are the first few lymph nodes that the dye and the marker go to. They're supposed to represent the first lymph nodes that cancer would also go to if cancer had already gone there. So if I take out the first few lymph nodes and there's no cancer in there, it probably hasn't gone to the other lymph nodes because this is the pathway it would have followed. If I go and take out those first few lymph nodes and there is cancer in them, then there might be cancer in the rest of them because you already saw that it went down this pathway. Okay? Okay, radiation. Radiation is fairly painless, well-tolerated treatment. It is what we call a local treatment. It's really 1 or 2 minutes per day, 5 days per week for about 3 to 6 weeks. And it really will cut down the chance of you getting a recurrence after a lumpectomy by half. So when we tell patients they have a lumpectomy and radiation, the chance of recurrence is probably about 12% to 15%, whereas if they have a mastectomy, it's about 1% to 2%. But if they don't have radiation, it's about 30%. Okay? So you need to have radiation to cut that down. Sometimes we have to give it after a mastectomy. There are some reasons for it that are listed there. Chemotherapy are to treat those micromets that are anywhere else, so disease that might be anywhere else in the body. It can be used sometimes before surgery to decrease the size of a cancer. So if a woman comes into me with one of those awful pictures from the before where it was a huge cancer there, and I don't even think surgery is very possible, you can get chemotherapy to try to shrink everything down to make surgery more possible. Okay. Also, we tend to give it if you have lymph nodes that are positive, we can often give it. If they're HER2 positive, there's a specific treatment for that, but they definitely get chemotherapy. Triple negatives will also always get chemotherapy, as well as really locally advanced cancers. There are newer tests that are going out there to help us determine the behavior of the ERPR-positive cancers, which are very slow growing, to see whether they would benefit from chemotherapy or not. You don't need to know too much about the details of that, but that has really changed the practice for medical oncologists. Okay? Herceptin is this monoclonal antibody that specifically fights the receptors for people who have the HER2s being positive. They always get that if they are HER2 positive. Chemotherapy lasts for about 3 to 4 months. It's usually given about every 2 weeks or so. Breast cancer chemotherapy does make you lose your hair, it makes you tired, it makes you nauseous, but it is temporary. Endocrine therapy, this is for patients who are estrogen and progesterone positive, okay? So this is the tamoxifen, raloxifen, and the aromatase inhibitors that we talked about as prevention. We use this to treat patients who have breast cancer. This is their main use. So if you're estrogen or progesterone positive, it means that your cancer cells have these receptors that are out there looking for the estrogen and progesterone that's in your body. If it gets it and it links it, it's going to downregulate and make things happen in the cell to grow and become more cancerous and spread elsewhere. So if you can deny these receptors from seeing the estrogen that's in the body, then that doesn't get downregulated and it doesn't grow. Does that make sense? So this is a very, very effective targeted therapy we have for breast cancer. There's really 5 different pills that you can give, depending if you're pre or postmenopausal. You can read about their side effects, but generally we give them for about 5 years. And it will decrease the risk of anything developing anywhere in the body by about 50%, which is pretty good for a pill that's well tolerated. Okay, HER2, we're running out of time. You can read about this. This is just that drug that people who get, who are HER2 positive get. This is a major advance in breast cancer treatment. Okay, they didn't have, they didn't even know what Herceptin was probably like 15 years ago, and now we have something to treat it, which is great. Local recurrence, you can have recurrences. Recurrences can either happen within the breast itself, in the lymph node region, or somewhere else in the body that's distant. So we are always watching for that. It's most commonly going to happen within the first 2 years or within the first 5 years after that. And so that's why we're always getting mammograms, which you want to look at the skin as well. And you always want to, if you have a recurrence of breast cancer, you want to look at the patients, have them scanned again to make sure they didn't develop disease somewhere else in their body at the same time. I'm not going to talk about this. That's a big trial. Some special considerations. Inflammatory breast cancer, this is the most aggressive form of breast cancer. Okay, it is something that is often mistaken for infection. The breast is a little bit red, the skin is a little bit swollen, and it's pretty rare. It only happens in about 0.5-1% of breast cancers. Patients will come in saying their breast feels super heavy, it's red, it's swollen, and it's happened within less than 6 months. They might have gone to their primaries, gotten antibiotics for it, it hasn't ever really helped. This is, again, very aggressive. They always get chemotherapy first. The treatment after that is a modified radical mastectomy, meaning we take the entire breast, including the lymph nodes, at the same time, and they will get radiation afterwards as well. This has the highest fatality, the 5-year survival rate of inflammatory is probably somewhere around 40 to 50%, much, much, much lower than our other breast cancers, okay? You always want to make sure they don't have disease anywhere else in the body first, because about 30 to 40% of them will present with disease elsewhere. Okay. Paget's disease, this is disease of the nipple. Paget's had a lot of things named after him. If you go into medical school, he has tons of diseases, whoever he is. It's usually a non-invasive cancer that is within the nipple itself, so we usually have to take the nipple off with that. Hormone replacement therapy in breast cancer, just you can read about it. Obviously, hormone replacement therapy can increase your risk of breast cancer. Should not be used in patients with a history of breast cancer, obviously. And is one of the known controllable risk factors that we have. Pregnancy and breast cancer is another situation. There are obviously younger women who get breast cancer within the pregnant period or the year after they are pregnant. It's starting to increase in incidence, especially as women are delaying their childbearing more and more often. Most of these cancers are ductal. They tend to be larger because they are palpable when they're felt. And they should obviously be referred to genetic counseling, because women who are young enough to be pregnant are probably under the age that they should normally be for breast cancer. Generally, you can do an MRI with it. You can do a mammogram if you shield the abdomen so that the fetus is controlled. Surgery is possible in all trimesters. The only thing with surgery is that you don't want to give a fetus anesthesia, so that's the real issue. But really the point of this is that you want to take care, in order to take care of the baby, you have to take care of the mother. So do whatever you got to do for mom so that the baby can be healthy if mom is healthy. If mom's not healthy, then there's really not a huge point to helping the baby through that, okay? They can't get radiation, we talked about, so most people opt for a mastectomy. Or if they find out that they have the breast cancer later in pregnancy and it can be delayed, they might be able to get a lumpectomy. They can get chemotherapy, kind of shocking, but it's true. It does not cross the placental barrier. Although no one's ever done a trial on it because no one will sign up for that. But it is possible to use that, although there are certain kinds that you probably do or do not want to use. Again, you can't give radiation, but they can breastfeed afterwards. We talk about pregnancy termination, but it's not been shown to improve survival or anything, so a patient can terminate their pregnancy if they should so choose, but it doesn't really help the situation in terms of their survival, so we don't encourage it if they don't want it. And then nipple discharge, I think I'm way over time. You can read about it. Not all nipple discharge is that important to us, but bloody nipple discharge is probably the most common kind of discharge, and the most common reason for bloody nipple discharge is something called an intraductal papilloma. That comes up on tests like all the time, but it's unlikely to be a breast cancer. And that's really about it. So that was a lot of material. Any major questions I can answer for you? If not, if you have any questions or anything, you can email me. Everyone at Roswell's email is just firstname.lastname@roswellpark.org. So mine is jessica.young@roswellpark.org. Okay? All right, thanks for your attention.
Okay, does it work? Can you hear me? All right. Okay, so I was asked to give a 30-minute talk about the breast cancer translational research. And this has to do with something I'm doing in my research. And but frankly, this is a very broad area. And it's almost impossible to cover everything related with translational research in breast cancer. So I'm going to be quite brief, as I know everyone wants to get out of this room. So first, some brief introduction about what is translational research. And then I'm going to give you some examples from the almost the most recent breakthroughs in breast cancer translational research in order to give you a very superficial sense of what is translational medicine and what can be done and why it is so exciting right now to be in the translational research area. All right, so what is translational medicine? So it can have many different definitions, depends on who you ask. I think very brief, it can be the application of a discovery to the practice of medicine. So in other words, it's from bench in a laboratory to the bedside to benefit the patient. So there are three major phases of translational medicine as shown in this figure here. So the first is a discovery. You have an idea, probably based on some observation you made. And based on the observation, you synthesize a hypothesis. And then you go on to test the hypothesis doing basic research. And those research are mostly done in the public funded universities and institutes like Roswell Park. And based on the findings, you may be lucky to identify some target that you can develop drugs. And once those drugs are successfully developed, and then you can go on to test those drugs in patient populations. As you know, there are three phases of clinical trials, and if that drug succeeds in all those trials, and then finally get the FDA approval, congratulations, then you have a new drug target a new molecule, and then those can be moved to the patient care for treatment. But then even after the trial has been successful and the drug has been approved, safety and evaluation should still continue. This is another way to look at the translational research. This is called the translational research cycle. It's pretty much the same idea based on the observation. You synthesize a hypothesis and you go on to test the hypothesis in either population-based studies or in a lab model-based studies. And the discovery, if the discovery confirms your hypothesis and you have a drug at hand, then you can move ahead to those trials. And when the trials are successful, then you can get the FDA approval, the clearance to move the drug into clinics. And those are just drugs that I have been talking about, but there are also another major area of translational research is has to do with biomarker. So biomarker is not necessarily a drug that treats patients, but it can be certain biological molecules or tests that you can run that can be useful in guiding the treatment. So I will talk more about those in the examples I'm going to talk about later. So the translational research, translational oncology in particular, has in the last 10 years has been extremely successful. As you would imagine, in the last decade or so, there has been explosive growth in our knowledge of molecular biology and genetics of cancer. And based on those vast knowledge base, we have a great repertoire of those molecules we can design drugs on. And here are just some big successful examples. There are numerous studies and the less successful stories here. But as you can see here, the EGFR mutation in lung cancer, and then the development of TKI inhibitor for those patients with the mutation. And then the Oncotype DX started in about 2004. I think Dr. Young just mentioned about Oncotype DX. And I'm going to talk about a little bit more in a second. And also in 2006, TCGA begins. So TCGA stands for the Cancer Genome Atlas, which is a big effort started by the NCI and NHGRI, trying to characterize the molecular portraits of a number of different types of cancers. And the goal was to genome over 10,000 tumors in 10 years, and that goal has been completed as we speak now. And also some interesting examples listed here also including the immunotherapy, especially the checkpoint inhibitors. If you are in the field of cancer therapy, this certainly is a big breakthrough. In the last several years, those anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 drugs have been been quite encouraging in treating some advanced cancers. And then also here it mentions the actionable mutations identified, especially those identified from CT's circulating tumor DNA and circulating tumor cells. Those I will cover too in a minute. And here is just a list of those drugs that were developed on the basis of tumor biology. And as you can see, for breast cancer, there have been several drugs targeted specifically for the estrogen receptor, which is the major circulating pathway driving the growth of a large proportion of breast cancer. And those including tamoxifen for Vostran, and aromatase inhibitors, including the latrozole and exemestane. And another successful story about breast cancer is the trastuzumab or the Herceptin that targets the HER2 positive cancer. And I'm going to show you an example how successful this HER2 drug, anti-HER2 drug has been. But not all those drugs were developed with a clear knowledge of their mechanism. Some of the drugs were actually developed without a clear knowledge of what the drugs do. So, and later studies can help to identify what really those drugs does. For example, the gefitinib, the EGFR inhibitor for small cell lung cancer, those targets were actually identified after the drug had been shown to be effective. So the translational research can go, especially for the drug development, can go either way. It can be, ideally, it's prior to the development of that drug, but sometimes through the huge screening effort, those molecules or drugs can be identified first, and then you can go ahead to identify the targets, which hopefully will further improve the development of the next generation of the drug, or identify some biomarkers that can be used to guide the treatment using those drugs. Okay, here are just some four examples I'm going to talk about, and about breast cancer translational medicine, and those are kind of the breakthrough in the past several years in the field. And then at the end, just very briefly touching the idea of balancing the translational research between treatment and prevention. So this is a study published 10 years ago in JAMA. Several years prior to this, people have identified that gene expression can be used to identify molecular subtypes of breast cancer, and those breast cancers called breast cancer intrinsic subtypes certainly support the idea that breast cancer is not a single disease. It's composed of at least five subtypes, and those five subtypes has distinct genomic profiles and also has distinct clinical profiles that I will show you in just a minute. And this, what's interesting about this paper is that it shows that you can define the subtypes not just using the gene expression, but using the immunohistochemical markers, using three or five markers depending on what's available. You can use just those IHC markers to mimic the subtypes defined on the basis of gene expression. So that's why these subtypes, breast cancer subtypes, have been widely adopted in breast cancer clinical practice. Because gene expression is not is expensive first, and the data analysis and the interpretation has not been very straightforward. So it's not as easy applicable as the IHC in a clinical setting. So with those subtypes, here are their survival. This is disease-free survival, as you can see. Those five subtypes have distinct survival prognosis. As you can see, the luminal A and the luminal B, which are mostly the ER-positive, PR-positive, HER2-negative cancer. Luminal A is a HER2-negative, and luminal B sometimes is a HER2-positive cancer. Those two subtypes have the best prognosis, and then the basal-like, kind of in the middle, and then HER2 positive and the ER negative is kind of the worst. But when you remember, this study was done in 2006, and the data was collected even years before that, and this time well precedes the development of trastuzumab or Herceptin, the anti-HER2 treatment. So because of that, now HER2 positive patients has a better prognosis and better survival than basal-like breast cancer. And actually, basal-like, or sometimes people call it triple-negative breast cancer, is the one subtype with the worst prognosis. So I think this shows you how successful a targeted drug can be to completely reverse the prognosis of one cancer. And also, based on the gene expression assays, showing that those gene expression assay can be used to distinguish cancer subtypes of different prognosis. Same thing can be used probably to predict whether patients will benefit from treatment or not. So this is one of the multi-gene assay called Oncotype DX, or 21 gene assay. There are some other similar assays, such as the MammoPrint, such as the I forgot the name in the tip of my tongue, but anyway. So there are a number of different multi-gene expression assays that can be used to for breast cancer to test whether they are what kind of treatment the patient can get. So this is the 21 genes used in this assay. Five of them are just reference genes to use to normalize the data, and then the other genes can be classified into proliferation, HER2 and estrogen. As you can see, a lot of those genes are for estrogen and proliferation. So what this Oncotype DX does and when it can be used, Oncotype DX has nothing to do with screening or diagnosis or the definitive surgery to remove the tumor, but it can be very useful for just one thing. Once the tumor has been determined to be ER/PR positive, so the endocrine therapy can be used, and then the patient or the physician faces a question whether endocrine therapy alone is enough or chemotherapy is needed. That is a very big question. As you may know, that chemotherapy is not fun to have, and it has severe toxic profiles. And sometimes the patient may be very miserable on the treatment, and sometimes those misery may not be necessary. They may not need the chemotherapy at all. So Oncotyp DX comes to the rescue to determine whether a patient will benefit from chemotherapy or not. So what Oncotyp DX does is basically based on those 21 genes, and it can give you a score, and based on that score, it can put patients into three categories. So the first category, if you have a recurrence score lower than 10, that means you are at low risk, and the hormonal therapy will be enough, and you will be spared from the toxic chemotherapy. And then if your recurrence score is more than 25, then unfortunately, you do need to have a chemotherapy in order to reduce the likelihood of recurrence. And then one question that's still ongoing for the Oncotyp DX test is a middle group or a gray area. If you have recurrence score between 11 and 25, then what to do? This is, we are not clear still. You can either have hormonal therapy alone, or you can have hormonal therapy plus chemotherapy. And so in order to solve this question, one big trial was initiated a few years ago called TAILOR-X for node-negative, ER-positive breast cancer, and to test specifically what to do. So patients within the middle group with R score between 11 to 25 were randomized to either hormonal therapy alone or chemotherapy plus hormonal therapy. So this trial is still ongoing, but with the data, then we'll have a better idea of what to do with those patients. So part of the TAILOR-X results were published last year in New England Journal of Medicine, and this is just the this arm of the trial. So those with at low risk, they were treated with hormonal therapy alone, and this figure is just a Kaplan-Meier survival curve, and maybe the disease-free survival, invasive disease-free survival, recurrence, and then overall survival. And this is probably very boring, as it looks like. There's almost a straight line, and there's very little dip of the line. So that's actually good news. That means those patients, they generally do very well with the hormonal therapy alone. So this actually confirms the previous finding that those patients do not need chemotherapy. Hormonal therapy alone will be enough. So this is a big success for the Oncotyp DX test, and then we are still waiting to see what's going to happen to this middle group. Okay, move on to the next story, which is a CD46 inhibitor called palbociclib. This is a drug developed clearly to target the CD46. So CD46 and cyclin D1, those are the important cell cycle regulators that can integrate a number of mitogenic signals to promote cell growth. And CD46 and cyclin D1, cyclin E1, those genes are found to be amplified usually in breast cancer. Not all the breast cancer, but some breast cancer, usually the luminal cancers. So then this drug was developed to target this pathway and to see how successful that can be. So two trials published their results in last year. So this was published in the Lancet Oncology. This is the left panel is the disease-free survival, As you can see, the palbociclib plus the letrozole is the aromatase inhibitor that target estrogen signaling pathway. As you can see, the palbociclib plus the letrozole has a much better disease-free survival comparing to the letrozole alone. But when you look at the overall survival, you can see that this new drug plus the AI tends to be slightly better, but the test was not significant. This is another study published the same year on New England Journal of Medicine, showing this pretty much the same results. This is the progression-free survival, but it's a different combination. So this is the palbociclib with the fulvestrant. Fulvestrant is a drug target. It's an ER dagger. It's degrade ER very effectively and usually used for the advanced ER-positive cancer patients. So adding those two together, it significantly extends the progression-free survival from 3.8 months to 9.2 months at the median progression-free survival. So it's about 5-6 months, which is may not sound a big deal, but for those patient with this advanced stage disease, this is actually a big increase in their survival. So that's the CD46 inhibitor. Next story is the breast cancer immunotherapy, and this is certainly a big story in the past several years, but not much so for breast cancer. For breast cancer, those anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 has not been shown to be extremely successful yet. So this is just a figure to show, this is an extremely simplified figure to show how this drug works. So tumor cells usually present some antigens, and those antigens will result due to their mutated genes. And those mutated genes will produce some mutated proteins, and those proteins can be presented as a new antigen on the surface of the tumor cells. And because those proteins are new to the immune system should recognize those antigens and then kill those cells if the immune function is not suppressed. But a lot of tumor cells, they have a mechanism to escape those the immune surveillance. And one mechanism is through this PD-1, PD-L1 mechanism. So PD-L1 is expressed in the tumor cells, and then once it's bind to the PD-1 on the T cells, the CD8 positive T cells will not initiate killing against the tumor cells. So the idea here is to use an inhibitor to target specifically for those PD-1 or PD-L1 to block this checkpoint, and then hopefully, the T cells now will recognize the tumor cells as an antigen, and then can kill cells. So there are a number of drugs have been tested and are all in the pipelines for clinical trials. And here are just two examples of avelumab, which targets the PD-L1, and the pembrolizumab targeting the PD-1. And last year in the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, two abstracts were presented for breast cancer using the avelumab targeting the avelumab targeting the PD-L1, and then the other targeting the PD-1. And those are both studies are small studies, and they are not designed to test the efficacy of the immunotherapy drugs, but to test the safety of the drugs, actually. So, but they also have some efficacy data, survival data, so that's why they were published. And the first study shows that the response rate actually is pretty low for breast cancer, advanced breast cancer patients, and it's only about less than 5%. So 8 out of 168 patients respond to the drug. But when I look at those responders in detail, actually 5 out of 8 of them are triple-negative cancers. And we know that triple-negative cancer tends to be more immunogenic, and they have more immune cells surrounding them. So those could be consistent with that observation. And then out of the 5 triple-negative cancers, 4 had PD-L1 positive immune cells. So this also points to the speculation that triple-negative cancer may be particularly responsive to those treatment, and especially if we can test the PD-L1 positive immune cells as a kind of biomarker to guide the treatment, that would be great. That may increase the response rate. And the other trial with the anti-PD-L1 drug, it shows that the this is also in a ER in the ER positive HER2 negative setting, and the tumors are expressing PD-L1. And of the 25 evaluable patients, the response rate is not extremely exciting. It's 12%, and then another 8% with stable disease. So overall, 20% response rate, which is not great, certainly, but considering that those patients had almost a terminal disease, advanced metastatic breast cancer, so I think this certainly offers some new hope to those patients. And and there are a number of ongoing trials testing the immunotherapy drugs for breast cancer in combination with chemotherapy drugs. So we are still waiting to see how those trials turn out to be. All right, so that's about immunotherapy very briefly. And then next, liquid biopsy of the circulating tumor cells and circulating tumor DNA. So this is a paper published just this month, actually 2 weeks ago, in the Nature to summarize beautifully the roles of liquid biopsy that can be done currently. So one is circulating tumor cells. So when the tumor grows, especially if it's invade through the vascular system, it can release tumor cells into the blood or into the lymphatic system, and those tumor cells can then be spread to different organs and finally form metastasis. So then when we look at the blood of those patients, we can identify those tumor cells through their specific markers, and then using the number of circulating tumor cells in the blood as a marker, as a biomarker, to see how many tumor cells are there, and whether this can be used as kind of a prognosis marker or a biomarker for guide for treatment. And also, those tumor cells can also be harvested and isolated, then used for profiling of the cancer genomic profiles. This is very appealing comparing to the biopsy itself, because the biopsy, you need to insert some needles into the body and extract a small proportion of that tissue, and that process is certainly not pleasant to the patient. And it cannot be done sometimes too. But with the liquid biopsy, and if you are only going to look at the blood is much more accessible than the tissue itself, and then you can also do this repeatedly and along the treatment course. So that's why this the concept of liquid biopsy has been so popular in the past several years. So CTC is just one example, and then another example is the circulating tumor DNA. This has been very hot recently. So this is not to count the intact circulating tumor cell itself, but to count the cell-free DNA floating in the blood. And so the human body constantly shed DNA into the blood, and this process occurs even in the normal healthy cancer-free individuals. But in cancer patients, this process can be accelerated, and more DNA especially those from tumor cells, can be shed into the blood. And by isolating the cell-free DNA and then to profile those DNAs for mutations or other somatic changes, then you can identify those tumor-specific DNA and use that as kind of a way to profile the mutations of the tumor. And then lastly, the exosome is another very new area that can also be used for liquid biopsy. I'm not going to talk about that in detail, but here is just another figure to show the CTC and the ctDNA, what can be done with them. So here is a paper 2 years ago on Lancet Oncology. This is a POLIS analysis of the CTC in breast cancer, and it's an aggregated analysis of individual studies. And they put the data together to see how well the data looks like after you have all those data together. And you can see here the blue line is the CTC, the patient with CTC counts lower than 5 out of 7.5 male blood. And then the red line is those with CTC count larger than 5 out of 7.5 male. And apparently this is the progression-free survival, and this is overall survival, no matter which. You can see those with high CTC count had a worse disease-free survival or the overall survival. So CTC is clearly a prognostic marker. And this is another way to look at the data, is to look at the change of the CTC over the course of the treatment. And as you can see here, the red line is those with stable increased. So the CTC level remains high despite treatment. And then the blue line is, the green line is those with stable low CTC. And those two are respectively the worst and the best group. And then those with changes actually is in the middle. So this, I think those results show that the CTC is not extremely responsive to treatment just based on this data. And then this was confirmed later in studies comparing CTC with ctDNA. Actually, some studies showing ctDNA is more responsive than CTC to the treatment. And then this trial was designed to test one thing that's very clinical relevant. Is, okay, now you have seen that the CTC is prognostic for breast cancer, but then what to do with this information? So this trial was designed to have three arms. Those are all metastatic breast cancer patients. And the first, so at the enrollment of the trial, all the patients undergone the CTC evaluation at the baseline. And if at the baseline they were determined to have CTC lower than 5 out of 7.5 male blood, then they were at low risk. And then those patients were treated at the discretion of the physician's decision. And then if the initial CTC is larger than is higher than 5, then those patients were followed up, and they were treated with the first cycle of chemotherapy. And after 21 days, they were evaluated again for CTC count. And then based on the count, the patient was separated into two groups. So the arm B, if their CTC count has decreased to lower than 5, then this is at moderate risk. And then those patients will continue their treatment as they have. And then for arm C, if they continue to have a high number of CTC count after the first cycle of the chemotherapy, then they were randomized into two groups. One group maintained their therapy, and another group switched their separate therapy to another regimen. So the hypothesis was to see whether the switching of chemotherapy actually changed the course of the disease. And this result is quite confirming, showing that this is the overall survival for these three arms. As you would expect, the low-risk group has the highest survival, and then the high-risk group has the worst survival. And this is overall, and this is the luminal A subtype. this is triple negative subtype, and then this is HER2 positive. As you can see here, those triple negative subtypes, no matter how many CTCs you have, the prognosis is really poor. But this is quite this figure is quite disappointing. That's why this paper ended up in JCO, but not in New England Journal of Medicine or JAMA. So the arm of C1 and arm of C2, there's absolutely no difference in the overall survival or the progression-free survival. So that means, those patients have constantly high CTC count, and then we switch therapy to another regimen, but that actually did not help them. So this means that CTC here is not particularly useful in guiding the treatment, but it could also be interpreted as that the switching therapy alone may not be enough. Some other treatment or targeted treatment may be necessary for those patients, but that will be tested in a set of other trials in the future. Okay, that's CTC, not extremely successful so far for breast cancer. Then for the circulating tumor DNA, as I said, this is not to count the cells in the blood, but to profile the tumor-specific DNA in the blood. So this study was published last year for breast cancer, and it's a serial monitoring of the ctDNA in patients with in order to detect their micro metastatic disease. So the study protocol is that they first got the primary tumor, and then they did whole genome sequencing to identify the tumor-specific chromosome rearrangement, and then with those rearrangements, then they can develop droplet digital PCR, which is highly sensitive assays designed to test those rearrangement. And then they use the assay to test the samples collected at the time of before surgery and after surgery, and then during follow-up until the patient had a recurrence. As you can see here, at this is a time point where the patient developed a clinical recurrence that's symptomatic, that can be detected by imaging technologies. But when you look at this, the ctDNA, you can see those, especially the rearrangement 1 as a marker, that increased almost 13, quite, not 13 months, many months before the recurrence becomes clinical symptomatic. And this is another study published also last year using a different technology to profile the circulating tumor DNA and use that to predict early relapse in early stage breast cancer. So what they did is to, this is a new adjuvant setting, so those patients were treated with chemotherapy first before they got their surgery. So the biopsy was taken and the samples were used for massive parallel sequencing to identify the mutation. And based on the mutation, they designed specific digital PCR assays to track those DNAs, tumor DNAs in serial blood samples. And once they identify the tumor DNA, then they went back to do high throughput sequencing, trying to identify all the mutations present in the ctDNA. So here is one patient that's shown very sensitive very high sensitivity of the ctDNA. So this DNA is the p53 mutation, and the patient first had chemotherapy, and at that time it had detectable p53 mutation, and then it had after chemotherapy. The surgery went on to remove the bulk of the tumor mass, and then at that point, the ctDNA of this particular mutation was almost undetectable in the blood. And then during the follow-up, 6 months, 12 months, 14 months, and at 19 months, finally, metastasis was detected in the liver. So at 19 months, you can see there are metastatic site in the CT scan. But even at 14 months, at a CT scan, there's it's not identifiable. But when you look at the ctDNA level, it's already started to increase at 6 months. So there is almost 13.5 lead over time for the ctDNA to be sensitive, more sensitive than the CT scan. And this is another example of one patient, and it went back to do the massive parallel sequencing for the ctDNA, trying to identify what kind of mutations are in those samples. And they compare three different types of samples. One is the primary tumor, and then you can see the allele frequency of those five mutations. And then this is the ctDNA collected at 6 months before disease relapse. And then those, and then this is a tumor metastatic at relapse. As you can see here, the surgery and the chemotherapy works really well. It almost kills off all the primary tumor. And then at some point, the tumor starts to grow back. As you can see here, those mutations start to pick up at 6 months and 12 months. But one interesting finding about this study is that there is one mutation, that's the RB1. It's not detectable even at 12 months, and then some, and then it starts to increase at maybe this is 16 months, and so this is a really represent a subclone of the RB1 that starts later. It's not in the primary cancer. It's maybe a new clone expanded at metastatic site. So I think that this result shows that ctDNA is certainly very useful, but it's not as sensitive as we would like, because there could be many reasons for that. I think here the late clones developed at the metastatic site may precede the detection of those mutations in the circulating system. Okay, lastly, all those beautiful stories about cancer treatment is deal with the patient already have cancer, but then I don't think we can really treat all the way out of the problem of cancer. We need really to think about how to prevent cancer. So there are a lot of translational efforts ongoing in order to leverage the molecular targets we have already identified for better prevention efforts, and those studies should really be paid more attention to in the future in order to reduce the cancer burden. So that's all what I have to say, and if you have any questions, let me know. Here is my contact information. No questions? All right. Thanks.